Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, Nancy Giordano. She's a strategic futurist and speaker and CEO of Play Big Inc. and Cultural Acupuncture. We're going to be talking about some stuff that you can't even imagine as we talk about the big shift, what leaders must know about the new economy. Are you ready? And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're going to be speaking with Nancy Giordano. She is a strategic futurist, and she helps drive organizations and individuals to transformative leadership and brand salience. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you know, I understand you spoke up at the New Hampshire Strategic HR Convention up at the Mount Washington there a couple of weeks ago. I got to tell you, you were great. You know, tell me a little bit about your talk.
You know, it's always a privilege to go and talk to any audience, but particularly one that is so focused already on the organization and thinking through what it means to hold talent and culture in that way. So it was great. It was a great conversation around the needs of the future.
Well, you're a strategic futurist, and for those in the audience who obviously may not know what that is, could you define that a little bit for them?
I know, I laugh. My children tease me about having made up my own job. And I guess in some ways I have, but it feels, I think, a really unique need, which is helping leaders and organizations understand the needs and expectations of the future. Things are changing and transforming so quickly, it sets up a completely different set of how to approach it, and so I help organizations understand how to meet and build strategic plans and pathways to that future and ensure their relevance. And, you know, the things, just because you've been around for a really long time doesn't mean you get to stay around. And so what does it take to continually innovate and build relevance to the future?
So, you know, one of the other things that I know about you, based upon your bio and having a conversation with you up there, because obviously it was a great event, is the fact that you were the first curator of a TEDx talk. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I was the first licensee for TEDx. So TEDx is the ability to create an independently organized TED event. And so I was the first granted a license for that. I was one of probably about 10, maybe, in the very beginning in the United States who created the very first one. And, you know, it's taken off. It's a worldwide movement now. It's pretty extraordinary to see how it's almost in every city around the world.
You know, it is amazing how much TED Talks have really become, you know, so mainstream. I remember when they first started, and it was different than what it is today. It's unbelievable.
It is extraordinary. And I mean, it existed for 20 years before it ever went online. So it's been around since the mid-80s, and it has definitely shifted a lot over the years. But it was really designed to pull, you know, thoughtful people together, cross-disciplinary people together, and given up a forum to be able to exchange ideas and say, hey, I'm working on this, and this is why it's cool, and this is why I'm working on this, why it's cool. And it drove a lot more collaboration and innovation across those original disciplines of technology, entertainment, and design. And we see that happening more and more now. That's part of what this conference was about. It's why we gather together, right? We want to learn and share with each other to accelerate our understanding so we can make really good choices moving forward.
And you're also helping to build the TEDx Austin, and I believe you lead one of the largest youth-driven TEDx events in the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm really proud of that. We've done 4 TEDx Austin events for adults, and then at one point I did 2 in 1 year, 1 for adults and 1 for teens, and realized that the 1 for teens was actually really, really extraordinarily satisfying, and so I've switched my energy there. And this year we're creating our 5th TEDx Youth event. It's youth-led, adult-mentored, and the event is hosted for about 900 to 1,000 youth in the Austin and greater Austin area. We have kids from 85 schools who attend.
Now, that's extraordinary. And what a great thing to be part of. I mean, just to see the youth-driven energy, right? And it's got to be amazing.
Well, I mean, actually, it's interesting because it really informs a lot of my thinking around how to build organizations and culture in the future, right? Because we're a completely distributed team. None of us have an office. We don't go to the office every day. Probably collectively over the course of a year, we see each other maybe 60 hours, I think we once did the calculation, and yet we put together a world-class event that's got, you know, 10 or 12 speakers, performers. It's got an hour and a half break where kids are involved in 15 different activities. We have partners. We have food. We have, you know, all those pieces that you need to do to put a really first-class event together. And yet we do it in a really unique and extraordinary way. And it's a chance for these kids to demonstrate or even find often and discover a passion for creation of some sort. So whether they're really great with partners or whether they're great with logo design or whether they're really great with logistics or building out a stage, or talking to our speakers, they get to be, you know, themselves in a really real-world environment, and they blossom in a way that's I can't even describe for you. So for, it's phenomenal to mentor a team like that for a year, and then obviously it's really very rewarding to open up that kind of trajectory for the audience. They get exposed to ideas and things that they haven't been, and they're not in a competitive environment. They're not doing it for a grade. They're not doing it because their parents forced them there, right? They're really led there completely by their curiosity. And are open to whatever it is that happens that day. So, yeah, it's my favorite day of the year.
Do you have, I can imagine it would be. Do you have a story maybe that you could tell the audience about maybe somebody that really caught you off guard and really was this shining, crowning, achieving moment of you know, watching this Youth Driven TEDx event?
Well, gosh, there's so many moments. I mean, the things that I think that touch me most is, you know, when a speaker gets a standing ovation by a crowd of teenagers. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, right, is to get close to 1,000 teenagers up on their feet applauding. There was a woman who had survived a really horrific several years in Uganda, and she talked about her story, and the kids just completely responded and understood this woman who had been disfigured and this woman who had had just such a will to live, and they just embraced her and loved her. And so there was just, and she was so petrified of being on the stage, and yet she was received so extraordinarily warmly. So certainly moments like that, that, you know, have sort of changed everyone. We've had several of those kinds of speakers that have really touched our kids. But I think also just the ones that, you know, open up a science pathway or open up, there's a great one from a football player who'd been injured and became an artist. Or there's a great one from a girl who just loves the periodic table so much and wanted to, you know, express her love of chemistry to everyone else. And at the end, recognized that not everyone was quite as passionate about the periodic table, but invited them to find their own passion. And I think that's really what it's about, right, is turning on the curiosity. I talk a lot about that. There's four ways in which we prepare our youth for the future. It's not about the classes they take or the majors, but it's really cultivating curiosity, empathy, agency, and grit. And you know, our event is designed to be certainly a pathway for that.
And what were those four again?
Curiosity, right? You're always staying open and being in a place of wonder and really tapping into your own unique curiosity, because we each have something that we're really passionate about and we bring it forth. We bring that, you know, really unique gift. Empathy, in the sense that we can, you know, put ourselves in someone else's shoes and design solutions that are really relevant for others and or address needs that are really relevant for others. Agency, which to me is a really, really big one these days for kids, which is a sense that they have the competence to go solve a problem or to, you know, launch an opportunity. They see within themselves that they are capable. I think that we often strip that out of our kids because we want to help them be successful, and unfortunately we're kind of doing the opposite, right? We're robbing them of that resilience and that sense of can-do, and then the rest is grit. You know, they're so used to seeing things happen so quickly and so easily for 16-year-old rap stars or the billion-dollar app designer, and I think really teaching kids that it takes more than one shot at something to necessarily pull it off, and you get better with time. So to me, those four, if the kids can recognize those four in themselves, they were prepared for whatever ambiguous future we're all walking into.
No, I think those are really outstanding traits that you're talking about. You know, one of the things that's interesting is how technology has changed the way the message is delivered and the message is received. Have you seen, especially in the last, and we're going to certainly talk about your talk here in a few minutes, having to do with, you know, the big shift, what leaders must know about the new economy, but have you really seen, especially with the youth, that technology has been helpful and at the same time maybe a challenge?
Well, I think I love that you open up both pathways, right? Because we're used to, like, pushing down technology and making it sound like it's the root of all evil, and yet I can show you, you know, stories from the turn of the century or from even before that, when radio was first introduced or newspapers were first introduced or TV was introduced or comics were introduced, about how they were going to be the ruin of our youth. And we haven't seen that, I think, to be true. And so the question really is, this is a new way in which kids are expressing themselves, and they need to be taught guidelines, and I would argue good, like, technical hygiene, if you want, or digital hygiene, about how to keep themselves safe and how to take care of others in that environment, just like you would teach them how to write, you know, thoughtfully, and how you would show up in other ways. But I do think it is not something that parents should be so scared of, but there's something that parents should have more partnership in. You know, we've seen in our own school district as iPads came into every grade, every kid in our school now from kindergarten to high school has an iPad, and the parents were the ones who were most freaked out because we didn't know how to put any kind of controls at home on it. And so I think really building a respectful rapport with your kids around that is really critical because this is the tool of the future. You know, there's a great friend of mine who wrote a blog post about, you know, if you imagine through time that parents admonish their kids for using the new technology of the day. So when a kid was, you know, scrambling, you know, in the dirt with a papyrus, and the parents were like, no, you get back out in that field and you, you know, plow. Don't you be sitting there practicing writing, right? Or when the kids were discovering books in the Renaissance, and the parents were like, no, you go help your father who's a blacksmith. That reading will get you nowhere, you know? I feel like in some ways we're in that same place now where we need to encourage our kids to be really facile with these tools, but not, you know, so absorbed that they can't do whatever they need to get done.
No, that's an excellent point. It really is. It's an excellent point. You know, and I guess it's just generational. It continues. There's always going to be something.
Yeah.
Right? You know, rock and roll will never be, you know, will poison your mind, poison your ears. I mean, you can go through everything, right?
The fear of all generations. But I do believe, again, that parents need to have, you know, a very respectful relationship with their kids in that technology. My kids know that I can read anything that they've ever written. You know, I have the a social contract with them where I can pick up their phone at any moment and I can look at whatever they're doing. And they get that. And it's not because I'm trying to be, you know, a dictator. It's because I'm trying to keep them safe and I need to know what they're up to. So I think we're just rewriting some of the rules and we're trying to figure it out.
No, you're absolutely right. And, of course, we're talking with Nancy Giordano. She is the strategic futurist and speaker. She owns Big Play, Inc. and Cultural Acupuncture. And, you know, we're talking today about, you know, some great stuff. She was up at the New Hampshire Strategic HR Convention. We're talking about the big shift, why leaders must know about the new economy. That was your talk, Nancy. I mean, tell me a little bit about the subject and what got you excited about it.
Well, my company is Play Big for a reason, right? It's really this idea about if you bring all of our resources and our equities and our knowledge forward, we have the opportunity to solve some really big problems and or create really huge and meaningful opportunities. It's about really thinking about the need right now of business leaders is not to show up in a transactional way, but in a way that really builds trust and, again, drives innovation. So we have this perspective that drives our thinking strategically, which is around we're moving from a culture of extraction to a culture of investment. So companies and organizations that think about, again, all the ways in which they can invest in their stakeholders, which are their employees, their partners, society, thinking about all the ways in which they touch an ecosystem in order to also still create a product and a service that people want to buy. You know, it's not anti-profit, it's very pro-profit. But we believe that in the future, partly because of this giant technical wave that we are our technological wave that we're barely at the front of. Trust will be a really, really important currency, and we need to think about ways that we develop that. So stepping back, you know, I just completed a conference that I produced that was all about the 7 most disruptive technologies and how they will change business. And so I can really get a good feature not just on the cultural changes that are happening, the demographic changes and the economic changes, which is sort of the first wave of the big shift. But we've got this other big wave. It's called AI and robotics and 3D printing and nanotechnology and VR, AR, right? And shifting cybersecurity and how we will interface with our machines. So, you know, it's kind of a phenomenally interesting world to be walking through. And, again, to learn different ways in which we show up as leaders and that we show up as creators in that space.
So, you know, you talk a little bit about the beginning of your presentation, the old way and the new way. And I love the little caption you have, and this is the old way. If you were really a good idea, someone would be already doing it, and we would follow late to market with an undifferentiated knockoff. I think that's hysterical and yet true, right? It is true in terms of that. And then you talk about the new way, which is our business model is one of very high risk. We dig a very big hole in the ground, spend $3 billion to build a factory in it, which takes 3 years to produce technology we haven't invented yet, to run products we haven't designed for markets which don't exist. We do that 2 or 3 times per year. That's really
isn't that amazing?
It really is when you
bold.
Think about it. I mean, that really is bold, right?
Well, just in context, that's a powerful quote from the former CEO of Intel and the way he described their business.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's factually true. I mean, there's no different. Apple does the same thing, right? I mean, they build technology,
Well, in fairness, you know, a company like Intel actually probably wasn't doing that well enough back in the day, and they missed the whole laptop revolution.
Right.
The tablet revolution, sorry. They were there for laptops, but not for tablets. And now they have really doubled down on wearables and decided that that's really the Internet of Things, and wearables is a hugely important place for them to be, and are building, you know, again, the chips and the infrastructure for that. They have an investment arm that incubates all kinds of ideas. I mean, they've really jumped in now and understood that the game is different than it was. And it requires that kind of foresight, that kind of commitment, and that kind of, you know, risk-taking, I guess. But what we try and do is reduce the risk, right? When you can see around the corner to what, again, the needs and expectations of the future are, and you can imagine, you know, how that drives purchasing, living, education, you know, transportation, all the things that we do in our daily lives will be shifted and changed by that stuff, then you can start to make those bets and not be so, I don't say afraid of them, but be more sure of them, right? They start to seem like they make more sense. We actually had the president of Global Logistics for UPS on the stage for our event 2 weeks ago, along with the CTO of 3D printing, or CTO of HP, who's leading the 3D printing revolution. Both of whom are really involved right now in building a 3D manufacturing network around the world. And you look at UPS and say, why are you building a 3D manufacturing network? Right? Won't that cannibalize your business? And Stan Dean did a beautiful job of sharing that absolutely not. It is the key to the survival of their business. And it follows a long history of their leadership taking those risks and moving forward and inventing the next service that, you know, we all needed from them. So it's really inspiring to be around people who see that and have the courage to build, as opposed to your point, sitting around waiting for the killer app and then deciding to jump in too late.
And we're talking with Nancy Giordano, and we're talking about the big shift, what leaders must know about the new economy. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Join your colleagues on Wednesday, November 9 at the Augusta Civic Center to learn, network, and get inspired at the 7th Annual Maine Biz Momentum Convention. Momentum is an annual convention hosted by Maine Biz aimed at fostering growth and innovation in Maine. It's a full day of learning and networking with industry leaders, peers, and customers. You'll spend the day with some of Maine's most successful CEOs, business owners, and leaders who will share insights and transformational strategies they use to launch their companies to new heights. Start your day with the Maine at Work Initiative Executive Breakfast. Attend Maine Biz U in 3 sessions with topics focused on the new Maine workplace, worker, and economy. And chart the course for your business by catching the keynote address delivered by IMSKIP. Register for your Maine Biz Momentum Convention Pass today by visiting MomentumConvention.com. That's MomentumConvention.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today we're talking with Nancy Giordano. She is the brand futurist and CEO of Play Big, Inc. I got that right, Nancy, right? Play Big, Inc.
Strategic futurist at Play Big, Inc.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We have you as both. Says brand.
I know, you know what, and actually what that does is represents a shift, right? Because in my career, I did used to describe it as a brand feature because I was really focused on brand and really the way that the brand created its products and really thought about how it marketed itself. And then it really shifted at some point because we realized it needs to be about the organization and the structure of the organization. It isn't just about how we communicate externally. It's really the mindset and the culture internally that allows an organization
there is no
to thrive. And so that was the shift in our...
Okay, well, that's good. So, you know, we're talking about this very important topic, and from my perspective, this big shift and what leaders must know about the new economy. One of the things that we've discussed here a little bit and I want to dig a little deeper in is the conversation about how technology, culture, and economics play a big piece of this and understanding why those three are so intertwined. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's the fundamental understanding of how this stuff is all shifting, right? And that is what drove the beginning of my work 10 years ago, or actually more like 12 or 15 years ago, where what we saw was people were coming in and sort of educating our, you know, executive audiences on just one piece of that over the course of a year. So you get a little demographic information in January, and you get a little technological information in May, and you get a little bit of, you know, the rest at the end of the year, and no one was stringing that together. When you really look at them, they are very knit. Right, so they're codependent on each other, and they form again how we feel about how we move forward, and you know, what kind of products and services we want, how we feel about our work, how we feel about our family, what we think is important to pay attention to in society. And so it's important to look at those shifts. And we did a big project a few years ago where we really dug into and met the people in the communities and the ideas that were shifting the future, and we walked away with a really sort of aha understanding about the fundamental truth we've been building all of our business strategies around and how they were no longer valid, and that there were sort of these new truths, and that's where we end up with the old economy, new economy language, right? But things like that we used to build all of our strategies to meet a growing and accessible middle class, and that has eroded. That is not the situation now. And you can argue lots of reasons why. You can argue if it's okay or not okay and whether or not we need to fix it. But the fact is income has gotten extraordinarily polarized. And we see that now affect every single category, right? So, you know, we've worked with a lot of food companies, and a lot of those, you know, big brands of food were targeted right at the center, and that center has gone away. So it's really important to look at, you know, again, how demographic or economic shifts are driving economic changes. I mean, demographic changes. We certainly see a whole new population rising. We see, you know, the whole conversation about millennials and post-millennials, poor Gen X, always gets left out of the conversation.
It's true. Really, they do. They're almost like don't exist, do they? It's amazing. Really.
I mean, really, there was an article that literally leapfrogged completely over them the other day when they were talking about leadership. And yet, Gen X is actually the generation that has brought about a tremendous amount of innovation. And because they are more individualistic and they are less tribal, they are the ones who have broken a lot of territory and a lot of new ground. Skype was invented by a Gen Xer. I think maybe eBay was, I believe, you know, Craigslist might have been. I have to go through and remember. Who the age of all the various inventors, but they have really been a very disruptive and transformative group. So I always want to give a shout out to Gen X. But when you look, think about it, I mean, you know, that certainly creates a big wave of change. And then, I mean, we just talked again about the technological and how it starts with, you know, computers. And it's interesting that people are right now still trying to absorb the shifts in mobile technology at the enterprise level. People are talking about cloud. And as I say, there's so much more to come. I'm deeply embedded in the world of artificial intelligence with my work these days, and you know, it's going to change everything, including food. I mean, it's not just for the tech companies and the banks. It's literally, I gave a talk to a bunch of food innovators and R&D executives, and we talked about the role that AI is playing in plant-based proteins and in farming and in distribution. So it's going to change everything. And hopefully for the better. You know, that's the invitation. We can use these technologies really responsibly, and we can use them to serve people rather than to stalk people. And as we make those choices, we're making very profound choices about what we want our future to look like.
You know, it's interesting. One of the quotes you have in the information that we've been going over, it says, "My biggest worry is that we're creating a world in which we'll have glittering technologies embedded in kind of a shabby society and supported by an economy that generates inequality versus opportunity." And that's Andrew McAfee.
Right.
That there's a lot of concern in that statement when you really look at what it's saying.
Yeah.
What's your take
Andrew
on
McAfee
that?
Andrew McAfee was one of the first people to start talking about a really radical idea called a basic guaranteed income. And I remember listening to his TED Talk years ago thinking, you know, that's utopian, you know, how that will never happen, particularly never in the United States. And it's really been fascinating to see that just in the last year or two, it has actually gotten a fair amount of attention. And it's something that even I think the presidential candidate, certainly Bernie Sanders, talked about for a bit. I'm not sure if he advocated for it or not, but it was on the table. And so it's this idea about how do you redistribute wealth in a way that everyone can benefit from the technological improvements. The productivity that's driven through technological advance. If we imagine that as we end up with autonomous vehicles or we end up with robots that do various things, it is possible that some, you know, work may disappear. There's a whole, big debate about whether or not we will create more jobs that are based on those technologies or whether or not we will lose them faster than we will gain them. So that's sort of the first decision. But even if we're able to maintain the rate of employment, the income will not necessarily get distributed equally, right? You will need less and less people to do something, or there less and less people will control the technology that makes something happen. And so the question then becomes, what kind of society is that, and how do we like the way that looks? And what are the alternatives then to be able to shift it? And there's different ones. You know, basic guaranteed income, which is one of the ones that Andrew put forth, is one. Being able to somehow have a different relationship with the data that we offer so freely to the companies that use this data to make money might be another. Thinking yet about how we pay the people who are currently doing the work and what we mean by minimum wage. And so there's lots of conversation, but it's coming from that. That's sort of the epicenter of that conversation is our thinking about productivity being driven in a really different way, and how do we ensure that everyone is on board for the solutions of that, or the benefits of that.
Is there a concern that, you know, the fact that this technology is shifting so fast, and the fact that, you know, HR and you know, other leaders out there dealing with people each and every day, that creates a feeling or a stressor that is being felt across the economy and being felt across, you know, corporate America in terms of how to deal with this, in terms of making sure that we also have production along with technology that keeps people employed? Because there is this conundrum that you hear, and you do certainly hear it in the political side, but just in the general statement of we need jobs, we need people who are working, we need people out there and doing things. And yet we're talking about technology in a futuristic state that is going to do more of that for us. How does that look from what you're hearing from people out there, what you're talking to people about? How does that look for the future?
There's multi-levels to that question. So the first is, you know, how inside organizations right now are they dealing with so much change? And are they holding people well in that? And are we developing people well and training people well? There's a whole conversation about, you know, continuous learning and constant training and always being at the forefront of that, which is in and of itself a cultural shift inside organizations and its own stressor. Right, and so how do we create that mindset of growth and that constant learning and support that at the same time that we're doing whatever the work is that needs to get done? So that's sort of the immediate layer, I think, that we need to pay attention to, and talks a lot again to mindset inside an organization. Is failure okay? What do we mean by failure? How do we learn? How do we constrain risk but yet still innovate? Like, all those conversations are the ones that we spend a lot of time with organizations on. Recently led a whole workshop on innovation for a big global auto manufacturer that was, and really our goal in that was just to hold people really safely in this expectation that they now need to go, you know, move from being in debits and credits to being innovators, right? How do we take really good care of people as we do that? And that then continues, right? To me, that just necessarily then cascades or escalates to the next conversation, which is as work changes and some jobs may no longer be relevant in organizations, how do we take care of people? How do we, again, either retrain them or ensure that they're leaving your organization with skills that make them still somehow marketable? And then the question will be, at some point, does work as we currently define it still look the same way? And I described that the sort of American view of work is, you know, energy expended to create an outcome that's paid by somebody else. And I think the reality is there's plenty of work to be done, but it doesn't necessarily paid by someone else. And so I, you know, would love to wave a magic wand and have this incredible society in which we are all fully actively doing something that is important to us and contributing to the community and the society around us, but the way in which we are compensated for that might look different. I often describe, you know, I have the luxury, I've got probably four roles on the planet, only one of which is paid. So I'm fully engaged in my world and in my life, but it is not all just for the dollar, and there's different currencies that I am paid by. And so, you know, one question will be, will society recognize that and make that possible to see in different ways and allow all of our needs to still met? So I don't know the answer to that. It can go many different ways. One of the things that we talked about at my event, GigaOM Change, was if I had a crystal ball and could have just one question answered about the future, the only one that I really want answered is, will we gain more jobs or lose more jobs? Because we will build very different societal structures depending on the answer to that question. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting question and a very futuristic question and appropriate from you in terms of those type of questions.
But it has implications right now. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't just for the future. Like, I got to help actually build an artificial intelligence company last year and build an internal culture and talent structure, which is why, again, it's so fun to talk to the audience last week, right? Because in some ways, I have a lot more empathy now for that work. I was technically, human resources. And we spent a lot of time talking about, as we were going to grow this company over the course of years, and as we were going to change the shape of the what we call the builders, the people that worked with us, both inside and outside the organization, how would we ensure that we weren't just extracting all this from them and kind of letting them go, that we were going to continue to invest in and build capacity and talent inside these folks so that whatever came next, they would be prepared for it. There's a responsibility in that I think is really important. It's a really extraordinary role for HR leaders and executives right now to think through.
Do you think they're really thinking through that at this point? Or really in... And the answer to that question is maybe, from my perspective. But the reality is people are so tactical today. They're worried about getting things done. They're worried about getting things right. You're being asked to do more with less. You're being asked to be, really focused on whatever it is. And HR is a cost center. It's not a production center. So the reality is that is under pressure as it always has been and always will be. You know, how does that HR profession actually open up and try to make that shift from, if you want to call it, to production, I guess is the best way to talk about it in that sense.
Yeah, I do think that there's lots of conversation about what the role of HR and whether or not the term HR even makes sense anymore and the importance that it plays in an organization. But most forward-thinking organizations actually are making that a C-suite executive position and are really inviting that very much into the forefront of the conversation for different reasons, partly as an ROI generator when we really think about how we are hiring people and ensuring the strength, the strongest productivity and engagement, right? This goes back to when people are fully engaged in their work, productivity goes up, and that there's more and more evidence that people are not engaged in their work. So that's why there's been so much focus on the HR and culture and talent management conversations. Then there's also the hiring. How do we find the people who have the skills that can do the work that need to get done? And then the next wave of that is find the mindset that can get done the work that needs to get done. So it's not just about whether or not I can code, but whether or not I know how to walk into an ambiguous environment and feel okay. I know how to work into a collaborative environment and have those skills that I can connect with others and I can, share tasks and projects and communicate clearly and all those things. So it is becoming a hugely important portion of the success of an organization is to think through those pieces. And I think, again, to your point, that's all that people are concentrating on right now, and there's multiple waves to come, which is why I love my work, right? My work is to go and help accelerate people's understanding of that, pay attention to those things that are right around the corner, help them understand why they're not as successful in what they want to be doing right now because they usually are too tactically focused, and focused, again, on a structure that is outdated. Right. Inside an organization, often we have hierarchy that doesn't help us anymore. We have a whole bunch of cumbersome bureaucracy that gets in the way. We try and hold on to and protect things that are no longer relevant to hold on to and protect. And then there's a whole wave of things that we can do to innovate better, work in teams better, distribute work better, compensate people differently, review and coach people differently. I mean, there's can go on and on and on.
No, it's very true. And by the way, we're getting ready to take a quick break, but I'm just curious, what do you think is the proper term for HR now if we're looking into the future? What do strategic thinking say at this point? What's the term?
I mean, you see everything from people works and talent management. And, for me, it was really about culture and talent. I was thinking a lot about that was what it was. And when I was actually recruiting for someone to run the sort of the talent side of it, I call it a talent community builder. I wanted somebody to come in and build a community of really extraordinary people and treat them as that. And what was interesting is when we put that job posting out, we got 50% more applicants than normally you would get for that kind of, if you want to call it, recruiter role, because we thought about it in a much more humanistic, much more relationship-oriented way. And so I do think that I would somehow name it something that references that. We are building a community inside an organization, and we want signal for and recruit the strongest people into it, and we want to develop them, and we want to be able to listen to them, we want people to empower them. How do we build organizations that do that?
We're talking with Nancy Giannano. She is a strategic futurist and speaker. And she's from Play Big Inc. and Cultural Acupuncture, which we'll talk more about right after the break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Hi, this is Senator Amy Volk. As I walk through the neighborhoods of my district meeting my constituents this election season, one message is clear at every door. People are fed up with the political discourse in Maine and throughout the country. I couldn't agree more. I, too, am sick of the partisan rancor and name-calling. I spent two terms in the Maine House and one term in the Senate working with lawmakers from both parties to accomplish real change for the people of Gorham, Scarborough, and Buxton. In fact, the nonpartisan Sunlight Foundation found me to be one of the most bipartisan legislators in Maine. This year, I was awarded a certificate of achievement from the American Conservative Union, indicating that while working in a bipartisan fashion, I was able to remain true to my conservative principles. It has been a privilege serving the people of Gorham, Scarborough, and Buxton, and I ask for your vote so I can continue the great work we accomplished this last session. I will return to Augusta and provide the experienced, principled, bipartisan leadership you've come to expect. This is Amy Volk. I ask for your vote on November 8th.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're having a great conversation, a futuristic conversation with Nancy Giordano, and we are talking about her company, Play Big Inc. and Cultural Acupuncture, which we're going to talk about here in a few seconds. But really the topic we're having more fun about is the big shift, what leaders must know about the new economy. Nancy, I said I would ask the question because as we went to break, we talked a little bit about the organization that you're calling Cultural Acupuncture. Describe that, please, because it sounds painful.
Yeah, it's a blog more than anything else. It was a place where we had, we get invited into large companies and get to help them think through some really big problems, and it's usually extraordinarily rewarding, but there are also times that it's really, really frustrating because we can see a solution around the corner that would be really useful, right? That we could see how it would be so relevant for them to deploy resources in a different way because we can see how the new economy is mapped. But often the leaders that we're working with, even at the C-suite level, don't see what we see. And so the solutions that we propose sound preposterous, right? I've gotten many notes from C-suite execs that say, you know, 3 years later, wow, everything you said came true or everything you said makes sense now. But they couldn't see it at the time. And I found that hugely frustrating. So each time I end up in a moment like that, I think, what can I create that helps solve that problem? And so Cultural Acupuncture was born out of that. It was desire to help executives understand how the world was going and accelerate their understanding of that. So I figured if every day we kind of posted some sort of provocative story, and originally it was designed to have a theme per week. We picked a theme from the Big Shift, and we would talk about whether it was food waste, or we would talk about technology in a certain way, or we talk about talent, or we talk about the economy, whatever it was, and I would present five different points of view on it, and then I would write a summary every Sunday and send that around to the executives in our world. And it has been very well received. I will also say, you know, like anybody else who starts something like that, you know, you get distracted. I got distracted when I worked inside the AI organization and had to fully concentrate on that. I got distracted as I was doing this big conference recently. So we have not been quite as dedicated to keeping that going, but there's a ton of really good content that we've put on there over the past 2 years that is still very relevant. So whether or not we, you know, keep up with it every day, it has become sort of our holding tank for helping put our thoughts into a form that other people can have access to and they can see what we're seeing. In some ways, it's basically sharing our eyesight as to what is shifting and changing. And if you see it in a slow drip every day, every week kind of way, it starts to seem more normal, right? We're trying to make the new seem normal.
And that is a challenge at times for the new to seem normal. Because what's normal? Because someone define normal for me, please. Dave, you want to help define normal?
I have no idea.
You have no idea what normal is here. Yes.
Well, but I'm going to argue it's where we feel safe, right? It's our comfort zone. And so what we need to do is be able to stretch out of our comfort zone into what we said earlier, cultivate curiosity. I would think, again, inside organizations, if we can incentivize people to be curious and we can incentivize people to build strong relationships, again, throughout the ecosystem, we will have really, really strong organizations. But we often don't. So cultural acupuncture was designed as a place for curiosity seekers, right, who want to know how this world is shifting and changing and want to be able to take that back into their organization, have a place to kind of find that content. And it's very specific to business leaders as opposed to, you know, everyone in general. I mean, everyone can get use from it, but it's really designed for people who are in business to think about the implications for them.
Yeah, no,
because,
I think...
again, they're sitting on the most resources, right? These folks need to be encouraged and empowered to make really, you know, big, bold moves.
You know, I think one of the things you talked about, in I would say in the last segment, had to do with employee engagement. And there's a quote here by Peter Kim, author of Social Business by Design, that says, individuals are taking power back from institutions, which drives a need for a new kind of engagement. Consumers are now sharing and learning from wide audiences, gaining confidence and clout. The temptation is to use these new channels in old ways. Think instead about the new opportunities that direct connection brings. It takes courage to change, but the value is exponential. Give me your take on that.
Well, I mean, Peter Kim is a big thought leader in the world of social media and social business. You know, we used to call it social media. We used to call it new media, right? And then it started becoming social media. Now it really is social business. And we describe it as social brain in the sense that we now all make decisions based on this sort of external relationship with others and what they know and don't know about something. And that will all be augmented, by the way, by our AI at some point. But right now it is, you know, what are platforms that allow us to connect with one another, whether they're rating products, whether or not they're giving us advice about whether or not to travel here or there, whether or not to, I mean, there's nothing that we don't buy these days, whether it's a restaurant or a company, that isn't somehow influenced by the ratings and opinions of others, right? So Glassdoor, again, becomes a really interesting thing. It came out of nowhere, but it has become a very influential player in the world of HR in the sense that people now can anonymously rank their organizations and rank their CEO and talk about whether or not they like or don't like it. It's a very interesting tool to go to if you're about to go work with an organization and see, you know, how people are feeling about it. So that exists everywhere. We'll also, you know, the part that people are in denial about is that we will also have that for salary transparency soon enough. So this whole idea that we can keep it all secret and people don't know is going to go completely falling away. And that's a lot of what Peter is talking about, that power, quote unquote, that were held by institutions of whichever form you want has been dismantled. And so, you know, what does that mean to show up in a world in which we can see everything and have access to more and talk to each other in all these different ways? It changes the game, right?
It does. It changes, but it's a paradigm shift. It's an absolute paradigm shift in terms of somebody, and you have generational challenges in terms of that paradigm shift, you know, in terms of older generations that may not be ready to make that shift, which traditionally hold the power in an organization or hold the power in a system, right, or a process.
Yep.
And then you have, you know, millennials, and we'll even say some Xers, but Xers are actually now coming into power. You know, it is an interesting shift to see whether or not they can actually change the mindset of the people in charge to make that happen. Do you see that?
I think of both directions. I do think it'll be really exciting as Gen Xers move more and more into the, you know, to the senior management and running organizations, because will they bring that sense of, again, independence and lack of hierarchy and a whole different way, a much more creative way of looking at things, or will they now have been inculcated? But hopefully they will bring that, because I've actually also met CEOs of large organizations that wanted to start to dismantle the bureaucracy, but the organization pushed back. And I've met many leaders, actually, who can see that there's a new way of doing things. They want people to you know, be more risk tolerant, if you will, to break down silos, to not feel like they need to have everything so assured, to wanting to break free. And you see the organization, sort of the middle management often is the one that's most sort of paralyzed by that invitation and doesn't really know what to quite do with it, because they thought that there's a certain way in which you ascend in the organization and all that is shifting and changing. And it is very discombobulating, for lack of a more strategic word. And so again, I go back to, how do we compassionately hold our talent force? How do we ensure that people don't feel threatened by that? Because under threat, nothing great happens, right?
No, as a matter of fact, resistance at that point becomes a real problem.
My favorite phrase is wonder and resistance can't coexist. And so how do we create the environments of wonder as opposed to the need to resist? So I think that, you know, there's generational certain plays to it, but I think there's also just recognizing that there is change happening, and whether or not you're at the top trying to drive it, or you're at the bottom trying to drive it, or in the middle trying to hold on, you know, the fact is we have to have open conversations around this. We can't deny that it's happening. And so you see, again, I think the biggest shift that's happened is that, you know, the number of people who go to Silicon Valley to go figure out what the heck is happening there, or come to Austin to figure out what's going on with entrepreneurs. They're trying to understand how organizations that constantly come up with new ideas that seem to create these ridiculous, you know, outsized market values operate. And so there's this mecca that has become Silicon Valley, or Austin, and maybe Boston, you know, certain places where they see these centers of innovation and change, and they're trying to figure out how to do it. So it's a wave.
But it's a wave that is needed, because obviously we don't have a choice. We don't have a choice.
No, it's going to happen to you, or you get to drive it, right? There's a number that a friend of mine turned me on to once when he went to USC School of Social Work, which is the largest in the world, as an innovator in residence. And he found that the number of years it takes for a new idea that has been well-tested, you know, has been well-validated in the field of social work to be widely practiced in the field is 17 years. It takes that long for the information to, you know, get disseminated across the field. And he found that horrifying, right? Because we're talking about people's lives and ways in which we can improve their well-being and whatever. It takes, you don't want to be with a practitioner who's on year 13, 14, 15. I think the same thing in business, and I don't think we get 17 years, right? The window is much shorter. So you get 10 years. And you hear those stories again about how Blockbuster, you know, resisted Netflix, or whichever other big company that's out of business now had the opportunity to reinvent, and they chose not to. And then they went away. So the pressure is real. And again, I want to not alarm people, but I want to invite people to the fact that these technologies that are around the corner, not just social and mobile and cloud, but AI and robotics and 3D and VR, are going to continue to create change and completely disrupt things and create tons of new opportunity. You know, again, I'm a mother of three teenagers, so you can imagine the intersection of being a mom and a futurist is a pretty interesting place to live, particularly for my children, because I constantly, you know, invite them into this world so they can see the things that are happening, so they can decide how they want to be a part of it, and not to be afraid of it, but to be agents of it.
Well, I think that's the key right there. There's the key. In other words, being able to keep your mind open, being able to look forward, being able to be open to listening and not being totally resistant. I mean, there is reason to necessarily initially to not necessarily, you know, believe in it, but that if you really do open up your ideas and your thinking, you'll actually see that there is a path forward. Now, it's going to look totally different, and as you and I both have said here today, there's no way to know necessarily what that's going to look like, but at least the thought process is in place.
Totally. And I think it's about, again, opening up to learning, as we talked about from the very beginning. Like, how do I stay curious and how do I learn? And again, I go back to, I think one of the biggest opportunities inside organizations is to align incentives with the way that we really want people to behave. So if we want people to be more curious, then we need to incentivize that, not just financially, but also socially incentivize that. I think it's really critical for people to build relationships inside and outside the organization that can help them. None of us know enough now to be autonomous in our work. And again, when you talk to the folks at HP who are building this 3D printing revolution, they will talk to you about the number of complex relationships they have now with materials manufacturers, with distribution people like UPS. I mean, there's so much more integration and interdependence. We saw that at Sprint. We've seen that with many, many organizations that we're a part of. So how do we, again, help people and incentivize people to do that? Because it holds them much better when they have that. They don't feel like they're doing this all alone. Right, there's nothing scarier than trying to imagine giant change and trying to figure out your way through it and thinking that you have to do this all autonomously. But that also then requires a shift in what I would call the ego of our work, and which is talk about humble audacity. Moving to a place of humility is actually a really strong place to be, because it allows you then to be open to learning and collaborating with others, which then allows you to create the audacious.
No, there's no question.
Shifting that whole thing.
When you're looking at this, and as we're getting ready to wrap up the show here in the next couple minutes, what are the couple key takeaways when you talk to HR? Obviously, you did a couple weeks ago, but here as you talk on the show to the audience, what are like key takeaways of things that leaders can do today to start thinking forward or make some small shifts? Because it's got to start in a small shift somewhere. And so what are some things that HR leaders, business leaders, people can do right now today to make a difference and start thinking forward in this way?
Well, as you saw in my talk, there's a slide where I talk a lot about what it means to play big, right? So we can talk about all these changes culturally and technologically and demographically and economically, and we can talk about what they mean for us as leaders and how we show up differently, et cetera, but at some point, it comes down to a decision about how we want to play this game, right? The game of business is a really extraordinary one. The whole conversation is on capitalism and the ways in which we use it. So for me, it is, I'm very pro-business, I'm very pro-capitalism, I'm very pro these institutions, but I think that they need to be redesigned, and I think we can then have this invitation as leaders to think about that. So for me, again, it's thinking about our business in terms of investment versus extraction. What is it we can do to really offer value? It's thinking about our businesses in a systemic way, not a siloed way. So what are all the ways in which, again, our businesses or our actions inside an organization touch others? Right. How do we build organizations that are really thoughtful around that? How do we build collaborative organizations? And how do we empower people to feel as though they've got a voice in this? Because, again, they will have it in one way or another. The question is whether or not we invite that to be part of the process or whether or not that stuff goes underground. So it's those kinds of practices where we start to think about what it means to build an organization that looks and feels and operates differently, but is better prepared then and is more resilient and is more agile as these new technologies and these new expectations come forward. I think it's an extraordinarily fun time to be in business. And the organizations that we've had a chance to work with or witnessed that are doing this well, it's exciting. I'm really turned on by what it is that I get to go do. But I have become a bit of a preacher around it because I think that it's a choice that we have to decide if this is the future that we want to take on. And when we do, it really opens up a ton. But to your point, when we resist, it creates a lot of suffering. And I'm here to try and alleviate that.
Well, Nancy, it has been fantastic speaking with you today. Of course, we are excited to have you, and everybody can, of course, go to hrpowerhour.com right after the show and click on your link and get to your information, and we'll certainly have the TEDx on there as well. I think it's important for them to know about the youth there in Austin and TEDx Austin as well. So, Nancy, it's been fantastic having you on the show today.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been a fun conversation, and wishing you guys all the best.
Yes, and so you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Tawny Alvarez with Veral Dana. In most situations, the events in the news and in society will leak into the workplace and often create HR nightmares that previously had not been considered. While the United States continues research on the Zika virus, it is important to understand how it may affect your work environment. OSHA, in fact, has issued a thorough publication that provides employers with best practices on precautions to take to protect employees working outside from bites from mosquitoes with the virus. Included in these recommendations are the provision of bug repellent to employees, requiring employees to wear long shirts and pants, and removing standing water from work sites, if at all possible. Contact a member of Veral Dana's Labor and Employment Practice Group to discuss more best practices with regards to the Zika virus.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m., or streaming live on WLOBRadio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.